Lipper Audio presents an unabridged recording of Me Before You by Jojo Moyes, narrated by Joe Hall, Anna Bentinck, Stephen Crossley, Alex Tregear, Owen Lindsay, and Andrew Wincott. This work is copyrighted 2012 by Jojo Moyes. This recording is copyrighted 2012 by W.F. Howes Limited. Lou Clark knows a lot of things. She knows she likes working in the buttered bun tea shop, and she might not love her boyfriend, Patrick. Will Traynor knows his motorcycle accident took away his desire to live, and now everything feels small and joyless. What Will doesn't know is that Lou is about to burst into his world, and neither of them knows they're going to change the other for all time. And now, Me Before You.
...2007 When he emerges from the bathroom, she is awake, propped up against the pillows and flicking through the travel brochures that were beside his bed. She is wearing one of his T-shirts, and her long hair is tousled in a way that prompts reflexive thoughts of the previous night. He stands there, enjoying the brief flashback, rubbing the water from his hair with a towel. She looks up from a brochure and pouts. She is probably slightly too old to pout, but they've been going out a short enough time for it still to be cute. Do we really have to do something that involves trekking up mountains or hanging over ravines? It's our first proper holiday together, and there is literally not one single trip in these that doesn't involve either throwing yourself off something or, she pretends to shudder, wearing fleece. She throws them down on the bed, stretches her caramel-coloured arms above her head. Her voice is husky, testament to their missed hours of sleep. How about a luxury spa in Bali? We could lie around on the sand, spend hours being pampered. Long, relaxing nights. I can't do those sorts of holidays. I need to be doing something. Like throwing yourself out of aeroplanes? Don't knock it till you've tried it. She pulls a face. If it's all the same to you, I think I'll stick with knocking it. His shirt is faintly damp against his skin. He runs a comb through his hair and switches on his mobile phone, wincing at the list of messages that immediately pushes its way through onto the little screen. Right, he says. Gotta go. Help yourself to breakfast. He leans over the bed to kiss her. She smells warm and perfumed and deeply sexy. He inhales the scent from the back of her hair and briefly loses his train of thought as she wraps her arms around his neck, pulling him down towards the bed. Are we still going away this weekend? He extricates himself reluctantly. Depends what happens on this deal. It's all a bit up in the air at the moment. There's still a possibility I might have to be in New York. Nice dinner somewhere Thursday, either way. Your choice of restaurant. His motorbike leathers are on the back of the door, and he reaches for them. She narrows her eyes. Dinner? With or without Mr. Blackberry? What? Mr. Blackberry makes me feel like Miss Gooseberry. The pout again. I feel like there's always a third person vying for your attention. I'll turn it on to silent. Will Traynor, she scolds. You must have some time when you can switch off. I turned it off last night, didn't I? Only under extreme duress. He grins. Is that what we're calling it now? He pulls on his leathers, and Lissa's hold on his imagination is finally broken. He throws his motorbike jacket over his arm and blows her a kiss as he leaves. There are 22 messages on his BlackBerry, the first of which came in from New York at 3:42 a.m. Some legal problem. He takes the lift down to the underground car park, trying to update himself with the night's events. Morning, Mr. Traynor. The security guard steps out of his cubicle. It's weatherproof, even though down here there is no weather to be protected from. Will sometimes wonders what he does down here in the small hours, staring at the closed-circuit television and the glossy bumpers of £60,000 cars that never get dirty. He shoulders his way into his leather jacket. "What's it like out there, Mick?"
"Terrible. Raining cats and dogs."
Will stops. "Really? Not weather for the bike." Mick shakes his head.
"No, sir. Not unless you've got an inflatable attachment. Or a death wish."
Will stares at his bike, then peels himself out of his leathers. No matter what Lissa thinks, he is not a man who believes in taking unnecessary risks. He unlocks the top box of his bike and places the leathers inside, locking it and throwing the keys at Mick, who catches them neatly with one hand.
"Stick those through my door, will you?"
"No problem. You want me to call a taxi for you?"
"No. No point both of us getting wet."
Mick presses the button to open the automatic grill, and Will steps out, lifting a hand in thanks. The early morning is dark and thunderous around him, the central London traffic already dense and slow, despite the fact that it is barely 7:30. He pulls his collar up around his neck and strides down the street towards the junction, from where he is most likely to hail a taxi. The roads are slick with water, the grey light shining on the mirrored pavement. He curses inwardly as he spies the other suited people standing on the edge of the curb. Since when did the whole of London begin getting up so early? Everyone has had the same idea. He is wondering where best to position himself when his phone rings. It is Rupert.
"I'm on my way in, just trying to get a cab."
He catches sight of a taxi with an orange light approaching on the other side of the road and begins to stride towards it, hoping nobody else has seen. A bus roars past, followed by a lorry whose brakes squeal, deafening him to Rupert's words.
"Can't hear you, Rupe," he yells against the noise of the traffic. "You'll have to say that again."
Briefly marooned on the island, the traffic flowing past him like a current, he can see the orange light glowing, holds up his free hand, hoping that the driver can see him through the heavy rain.
"You need to call Jeff in New York. He's still up, waiting for you. We were trying to get you last night."
"What's the problem?"
"Legal hitch. Two clauses they're stalling on. Under section, signature, papers..."
His voice is drowned out by a passing car, its tires hissing in the wet.
"I didn't catch that."
The taxi has seen him. It is slowing, sending a fine spray of water as it slows on the opposite side of the road. He spies the man further along whose brief sprint slows in disappointment as he sees Will must get there before him. He feels a sneaking sense of triumph.
"Look, get Callie to have the paperwork on my desk," he yells. "I'll be there in 10 minutes.
He glances both ways, then ducks his head as he runs the last few steps across the road towards the cab, the word Blackfriars already on his lips. The rain is seeping down the gap between his collar and his shirt. He will be soaked by the time he reaches the office, even walking this short distance. He may have to send his secretary out for another shirt.
"And we need to get this due diligence thing worked out before Martin gets in."
He glances up at the screeching sound, the rude blare of a horn. He sees the side of the glossy black taxi in front of him, the driver already winding down his window, and at the edge of his field of vision, something he can't quite make out, something coming towards him at an impossible speed. He turns towards it, and in that split second, he realizes that he is in its path, that there is no way he is going to be able to get out of its way. His hand opens in surprise, letting the BlackBerry fall to the ground. He hears a shout, which may be his own. The last thing he sees is a leather glove, a face under a helmet, the shock in the man's eyes mirroring his own. There is an explosion as everything fragments. And then there is nothing.
To 1. 2009. There are 158 footsteps between the bus stop and home, but it can stretch to 180 if you aren't in a hurry, like maybe if you're wearing platform shoes, or shoes you bought from a charity shop that have butterflies on the toes but never quite grip the heel at the back, thereby explaining why they were a knockdown 199. I turned the corner into our street, 68 steps, and could just see the house, a four-bedroom semi and a row of other three- and four-bedroom semis. Dad's car was outside, which meant he had not yet left for work. Behind me, the sun was setting behind Stortford Castle, its dark shadow sliding down the hill like melting wax to overtake me. When I was a child, we used to make our elongated shadows have gun battles, our street the OK Corral. On a different sort of day, I could have told you all the things that had happened to me on this route. Where Dad taught me to ride a bike without stabilisers. Where Mrs. Doherty, with the lopsided wig, used to make us Welsh cakes. Where Trina stuck her hand into a hedge when she was 11 and disturbed a wasp's nest, and we ran screaming all the way back to the castle. Thomas's tricycle was upturned on the path, and closing the gate behind me, I dragged it under the porch and opened the door. The warmth hit me with the force of an airbag. Mum is a martyr to the cold and keeps the heating on all year round. Dad is always opening windows, complaining that she'd bankrupt the lot of us. He says our heating bills are larger than the GDP of a small African country.
That you, love?
Yep. I hung my jacket on the peg, where it fought for space amongst the others.
Which you? Lou? Trina?
Lou. I peered round the living room door. Dad was face down on the sofa, his arm thrust deep between the cushions as if they had swallowed his limb whole. Thomas, my 5-year-old nephew, was on his haunches, watching him intently.
Lego.
Dad turned his face towards me, puce from exertion.
Why they have to make the damn pieces so small, I don't know. Have you seen Obi-Wan Kenobi's left arm?
It was on top of the DVD player. I think he swapped Obi's arms with Indiana Jones's.
Well, apparently now Obi can't possibly have beige arms. We have to have the black arms.
I wouldn't worry. Doesn't Darth Vader chop his arm off in episode 2? I pointed at my cheek so that Thomas would kiss it. Where's Mum?
Upstairs. Oh, how about that? A £2 piece.
I looked up, just able to hear the familiar creak of the ironing board. Josie Clark, my mother, never sat down. It was a point of honour. She had been known to stand on an outside ladder painting the windows, occasionally pausing to wave, while the rest of us ate a roast dinner.
Will you have a go at finding this bloody arm for me? He's had me looking for half an hour and I've got to get ready for work.
Are you on nights?
Yeah, it's 5:30.
I glanced at the clock. Actually, it's 4:30. He extracted his arm from the cushions and squinted at his watch.
Then what are you doing home so early?
I shook my head vaguely, as if I might have misunderstood the question, and walked into the kitchen. Grandad was sitting in his chair by the kitchen window, studying a Sudoku. The health visitor had told us it would be good for his concentration, help his focus after the strokes. I suspected I was the only one to notice he simply filled out all the boxes with whatever number came to mind. Hey, Grandad. He looked up and smiled. You want a cup of tea? He shook his head and partially opened his mouth. Cold drink? He nodded. I opened the fridge door. There's no apple juice. Apple juice, I remembered now, was too expensive. Ribena? He shook his head. Water? He nodded, murmured something that could have been a thank you as I handed him the glass. My mother walked into the room, bearing a huge basket of neatly folded laundry. Are these yours? She brandished a pair of socks. Trina's, I think. I thought so. Odd colour. I think they must have got in with Daddy's plum pyjamas. You're back early. Are you going somewhere?
No.
I filled a glass with tap water and drank it. Is Patrick coming round later? He rang here earlier. Did you have your mobile off? He said he's after booking your holiday. Your father says he saw something on the television about it. Where is it you liked? Ipsos? Calypsos? Skiathos. That's the one. You want to check your hotel very carefully. Do it on the internet. He and Daddy watched something on the news at lunchtime. Apparently they're building sites, half of those budget deals, and you wouldn't know until you got there. Daddy, would you like a cup of tea? Did Lou not offer you one? She put the kettle on, then glanced up at me. It's possible she had finally noticed I wasn't saying anything. Are you all right, love? You look awfully pale. She reached out a hand and felt my forehead, as if I were much younger than 26. I don't think we're going on holiday. My mother's hand stilled. Her gaze had that X-ray thing that it had held since I was a kid. Are you and Pat having some problems? Mom, I'm not trying to interfere. It's just, you've been together an awful long time. It's only natural if things get a bit sticky every now and then. I mean, me and your father, I lost my job. My voice cut into the silence. The words hung there, searing themselves on the little room long after the sound had died away. You what? Frank's shutting down the cafe. From tomorrow. I held out a hand with the slightly damp envelope I had gripped in shock the entire journey home. All 180 steps from the bus stop. He's given me my 3 months' money. The day had started like any other day. Everyone I knew hated Monday mornings, but I never minded them. I liked arriving early at the buttered bun, firing up the huge tea urn in the corner, bringing in the crates of milk and bread from the backyard and chatting to Frank as we prepared to open. I liked the fuggy bacon-scented warmth of the cafe, the little bursts of cool air as the door opened and closed, the low murmur of conversation, and when quiet, Frank's radio singing tinnily to itself in the corner. It wasn't a fashionable place. Its walls were covered in scenes from the castle up on the hill. The tables still sported 4 mica tops, and the menu hadn't changed since I started, apart from a few changes to the chocolate bar selection and the addition of chocolate brownies and muffins to the iced bun tray. But most of all, I liked the customers. I liked Kev and Angelo, the plumbers, who came in most mornings and teased Frank about where his meat might have come from. I liked the dandelion lady, nicknamed for her shock of white hair, who ate one egg and chips from Monday to Thursday and sat reading the complimentary newspapers and drinking her way through 2 cups of tea. I always made an effort to chat with her. I suspected it might be the only conversation the old woman got all day. I liked the tourists who stopped on their walk up and down from the castle, the shrieking schoolchildren who stopped by after school, the regulars from the offices across the road, and Nina and Cherie, the hairdressers, who knew the calorie count of every single item the buttered bun had to offer. Even the annoying customers, like the red-haired woman who ran the toy shop and disputed her change at least once a week, didn't trouble me. I watched relationships begin and end across those tables. Children transferred between divorcees, the guilty relief of those parents who couldn't face cooking, and the secret pleasure of pensioners at a fried breakfast. All human life came through, and most of them shared a few words with me, trading jokes or comments over the mugs of steaming tea. Dad always said he never knew what was going to come out of my mouth next, but in the cafe it didn't matter. Frank liked me. He was quiet by nature and said having me there kept the place lively. It was a bit like being a barmaid, but without the hassle of drunks. And then that afternoon, after the lunchtime rush had ended and with the place briefly empty, Frank, wiping his hands on his apron, had come out from behind the hot plate and turned the little closed sign to face the street. "Now, now, Frank, I've told you before, extras are not included in the minimum wage." Frank was, as Dad put it, as queer as a blue ganoo. I looked up. He wasn't smiling. Uh-oh. I didn't put salt in the sugar cellars again, did I? He was twisting a tea towel between his two hands and looked more uncomfortable than I had ever seen him. I wondered briefly whether someone had complained about me, and then he motioned to me to sit down. "Sorry, Louisa," he said after he had told me, "but I'm going back to Australia. My dad's not too good, and it looks like the castle is definitely going to start doing its own refreshments. The writing's on the wall." I think I sat there with my mouth actually hanging open. And then Frank had handed me the envelope and answered my next question before it left my lips. "I know we never had, you know, a formal contract or anything, but I wanted to look after you. There's 3 months' money in there. We close tomorrow."
3 months?
Dad exploded as my mother thrust a cup of sweet tea into my hands.
"Well, that's big of him, given she's worked like a ruddy Trojan in that place for the last 6 years. Bernard!"
Mum shot him a warning look, nodding towards Thomas. My parents minded him after school every day until Trina finished work.
"What the hell is she supposed to do now? He could have given her more than a day's bloody notice."
"Well, she'll just have to get another job."
"There are no bloody jobs, Josie. You know that as well as I do. We're in the middle of a bloody recession."
Mum shut her eyes for a moment, as if composing herself before she spoke.
"She's a bright girl. She'll find herself something. She's got a solid employment record, hasn't she? Frank will give her a good reference." "Oh, feckin' marvellous. Louisa Clark is very good at buttering toast and a dab hand with the old teapot."
"Thanks for the vote of confidence, Dad."
"I'm just saying."
I knew the real reason for Dad's anxiety. They relied on my wages. Trina earned next to nothing at the flower shop. Mum couldn't work, as she had to look after Grandad, and Grandad's pension amounted to almost nothing. Dad lived in a constant state of anxiety about his job at the furniture factory. His boss had been muttering about possible redundancies for months. There were mutterings at home about debts and the juggling of credit cards. Dad had had his car written off by an uninsured driver 2 years previously, and somehow this had been enough for the whole teetering edifice that was my parents' finances to finally collapse. My modest wages had been a little bedrock of housekeeping money, enough to help see the family through from week to week. "Let's not get ahead of ourselves. She can head down to the job centre tomorrow and see what's on offer. She's got enough to get by for now." They spoke as if I weren't there. "And she's smart. You're smart, aren't you, love? Perhaps she could do a typing course, go into office work." I sat there as my parents discussed what other jobs my limited qualifications might entitle me to. Factory work, machinist, roll butterer. For the first time that afternoon, I wanted to cry. Thomas watched me with big round eyes and silently handed me half a soggy biscuit. "Thanks, Tomo," I mouthed silently and ate it. He was down at the track, as I had known he would be. Mondays to Thursdays, regular as a station timetable, Patrick was there in the gym or running in circles around the floodlit track. I made my way down the steps, hugging myself against the cold, and walked slowly out onto the track, waving as he came close enough to see who it was.
"Run with me,"
he puffed as he got closer. His breath came in pale clouds.
I've got 4 laps to go.
I hesitated just a moment and then began to run alongside him. It was the only way I was going to get any kind of conversation out of him. I was wearing my pink trainers with the turquoise laces, the only shoes I could possibly run in. I had spent the day at home, trying to be useful. I'm guessing it was about an hour before I started to get under my mother's feet. Mum and Grandad had their routines, and having me there interrupted them. Dad was asleep, as he was on nights this month, and not to be disturbed. I tidied my room, then sat and watched television with the sound down, and when I remembered periodically why I was at home in the middle of the day, I had felt an actual brief pain in my chest.
I wasn't expecting you. I got fed up at home. I thought maybe we could do something.
He looked sideways at me. There was a fine film of sweat on his face.
The sooner you get another job, babe, the better.
It's all of 24 hours since I lost the last one. Am I allowed to just be a bit miserable and floppy, you know, just for today?
But you've got to look at the positive side. You knew you couldn't stay at that place forever. You want to move upwards, onwards.
Patrick had been named Storkfold Young Entrepreneur of the Year 2 years previously and had not yet quite recovered from the honour. He had since acquired a business partner, Ginger Pete, offering personal training to clients over a 40-mile area and 2 liveried vans on the HP. He also had a whiteboard in his office, on which he liked to scrawl his projected turnover with thick black markers, working and reworking the figures until they met with his satisfaction. I was never entirely sure that they bore any resemblance to real life.
Being made redundant can change people's lives, Lou.
He glanced at his watch, checking his lap time.
What do you want to do? You could retrain. I'm sure they do a grant for people like you.
People like me?
People looking for a new opportunity. What do you want to be? You could be a beautician. You're pretty enough.
He nudged me as we ran, as if I should be grateful for the compliment.
You know my beauty routine. Soap, water, the odd paper bag.
Patrick was beginning to look exasperated. I was starting to lag behind. I hate running. I hated him for not slowing down.
Look, shop assistant? Secretary? Estate agent? I don't know. There must be something you want to do.
But there wasn't. I had liked it at the cafe. I liked knowing everything there was to know about the buttered bun and hearing about the lives of the people who came through it. I had felt comfortable there.
You can't mope around, babe. Gotta get over it. All the best entrepreneurs fight their way back from rock bottom. Jeffrey Archer did it. So did Richard Branson.
He tapped my arm, trying to get me to keep up.
I doubt if Jeffrey Archer ever got made redundant from toasting tea cakes.
I was out of breath, and I was wearing the wrong bra. I slowed, dropped my hands down onto my knees. He turned, running backwards, his voice carrying on the still, cold air.
But if he had, I'm just saying, sleep on it. Put on a smart suit and head down to the job centre. Or I'll train you up to work with me if you like. You know there's money in it. And don't worry about the holiday. I'll pay.
I smiled at him. He blew a kiss and his voice echoed across the empty stadium.
You can pay me back when you're back on your feet.
I made my first claim for Job Seeker's allowance. I attended a 45-minute interview and a group interview, where I sat with a group of 20 or so mismatched men and women, half of whom wore the same slightly stunned expression I suspected I did, and the other half, the blank, uninterested faces of people who had been here too many times before. I wore what my dad deemed my civilian clothes. As a result of these efforts, I had endured a brief stint filling in on a night shift at a chicken processing factory. It had given me nightmares for weeks. And 2 days at a training session as a home energy advisor. I had realised pretty quickly that I was essentially being instructed to befuddle old people into switching energy suppliers and told Saeed, my personal advisor, that I couldn't do it. He had been insistent that I continue, so I had listed some of the practices that they had asked me to employ, at which point he had gone a bit quiet and suggested we... It was always we, even though it was pretty obvious that one of us had a job. Try something else. I did 2 weeks at a fast food chain. The hours were okay. I could cope with the fact that the uniform made my hair static, but I found it impossible to stick to the appropriate responses script, with its, how can I help you today? And its, would you like large fries with that? I had been let go after one of the donut girls caught me debating the varying merits of the free toys with a 4-year-old. What can I say? She was a smart 4-year-old. I also thought Sleeping Beauties were sappy. Now I sat at my 4th interview as Saeed scanned through the touchscreen for further employment opportunities. Even Saeed, who wore the grimly cheerful demeanour of someone who had shoehorned the most unlikely candidates into a job, was starting to sound a little weary. Have you ever considered joining the entertainment industry? What, as in pantomime dame? Actually, no. But there is an opening for a pole dancer. Several, in fact. I raised an eyebrow. Please tell me you are kidding. It's 30 hours a week, on a self-employed basis. I believe the tips are good. Please, please tell me you have not just advised me to get a job that involves parading around in front of strangers in my underwear. You said you were good with people, and you seem to like theatrical clothing. He glanced at my tights, which were green and glittery. I had thought they would cheer me up. Thomas had hummed the theme tune from The Little Mermaid at me for almost the whole of breakfast. Saeed tapped something into his keyboard. How about adult chatline supervisor? I stared at him. He shrugged. You said you liked talking to people. No. And no to semi-nude bar staff, or masseuse, or webcam operator. Come on, Saeed. There must be something I can do that wouldn't actually give my dad a heart attack. This appeared to stump him. There's not much left outside flexi-hour retail opportunities. Nighttime shelf stacking. I had been here enough times now to speak their language. There's a waiting list. Parents tend to go for it because it suits the school hours, he said apologetically. He studied the screen again. So, we're really left with care assistant. Wiping old people's bottoms. I'm afraid, Louisa, you're not qualified for much else. If you wanted to retrain, I'd be happy to point you in the right direction. There are plenty of courses at the Adult Education Centre. But we've been through this, Saeed. If I do that, I lose my job seeker money, right? If you're not available for work, yes. We sat there in silence for a moment. I gazed at the doors, where 2 burly security men stood. I wondered if they had got the job through the job centre. I'm not good with old people, Saeed. My granddad lives at home since he had his strokes and I can't cope with him. Ah, so you have some experience of caring? Not really. My mum does everything for him. Would your mum like a job?
funny. I'm not being funny. And leave me looking after my granddad? No, thanks. That's from him as well as me, by the way. Haven't you got anything in cafes? I don't think there are enough cafes left to guarantee you employment, Louisa. We could try Kentucky Fried Chicken. You might get on better there. Because I get so much more out of offering a bargain bucket than a chicken McNugget. Oh, I don't think so. Well, then perhaps we'll have to look further afield. There are only 4 buses to and from our town, you know that. And I know you said I should look into the tourist bus, but I rang the station and it stops at 5 p.m. Plus it's twice as expensive as the normal bus. Saeed sat back in his seat. At this point in proceedings, Louisa, I really need to make the point that as a fit and able person, in order to continue qualifying for your allowance, you need to show that I'm trying to get a job, I know. How could I explain to this man how much I wanted to work? Did he have the slightest idea how much I missed my old job? Unemployment had been a concept, something droningly referred to on the news in relation to shipyards or car factories. I had never considered that you might miss a job like you missed a limb, a constant reflexive thing. I hadn't thought that as well as the obvious fears about money and your future, losing your job would make you feel inadequate and a bit useless. That it would be harder to get up in the morning than when you were rudely shocked into consciousness by the alarm. That you might miss the people you worked with, no matter how little you had in common with them, or even that you might find yourself searching for familiar faces as you walked the high street. The first time I had seen the dandelion lady wandering past the shops, looking as aimless as I felt, I had fought the urge to go and give her a hug. Saeed's voice broke into my reverie. Aha! Now this might work. I tried to peer round at the screen. Just come in, this very minute. Care assistant position. I told you I was no good with... It's not old people. It's a private position. To help in someone's house. And the address is less than 2 miles from your home. Care and companionship for a disabled man. Can you drive? Yes. But would I have to wipe his... No bottom wiping required, as far as I can tell. He scanned the screen. He's, quadriplegic. He needs someone in the daylight hours to help feed and assist. Often in these jobs, it's a case of being there when they want to go out somewhere, helping with basic stuff that they can't do themselves. Oh, it's good money. Quite a lot more than the minimum wage. That's probably because it involves bottom wiping. I'll ring them to confirm the absence of bottom wiping, but if that's the case, you'll go along for the interview? He said it like it was a question, but we both knew the answer. I sighed and gathered up my bag ready for the trip home.
Jesus Christ, said my father. Can you imagine? If it wasn't punishment enough ending up in a ruddy wheelchair, then you get our Lou turning up to keep you company. Bernard! My mother scolded. Behind me, Grandad was laughing into his mug of tea.
Chapter 2. I am not thick. I'd just like to get that out of the way at this point. But it's quite hard not to feel a bit deficient in the department of brain cells growing up next to a younger sister who was not just moved up a year into my class, but then to the year above. Everything that is sensible or smart, Katrina did first, despite being 18 months younger than me. Every book I ever read, she had read first. Every fact I mentioned at the dinner table, she already knew. She is the only person I know who actually likes exams. Sometimes I think I dress the way I do because the one thing Trina can't do is put clothes together. She's a pullover and jeans kind of a girl. Her idea of smart is ironing the jeans first. My father calls me a character because I tend to say the first thing that pops into my head. He says I'm like my Aunt Lily, who I never knew. It's a bit weird constantly being compared to someone you've never met. I would come downstairs in purple boots and Dad would nod at Mum and say,
"Do you remember Aunt Lily in her purple boots, eh?"
And Mum would cluck and start laughing as if at some secret joke. My mother calls me individual, which is her polite way of not quite understanding the way I dress. But apart from a brief period in my teens, I never wanted to look like Trina or any of the girls at school. I preferred boys' clothes till I was about 14, and now tend to please myself, depending on what mood I am in on the day. There's no point me trying to look conventional. I am small, dark-haired, and according to my dad, have the face of an elf. That's not as in elf in beauty. I am not plain, but I don't think anyone is ever going to call me beautiful. I don't have that graceful thing going on. Patrick calls me gorgeous when he wants to get his leg over, but he's fairly transparent like that. We've known each other for coming up to 7 years. I was 26 years old, and I wasn't really sure what I was. Up until I lost my job, I hadn't even given it any thought. I supposed I would probably marry Patrick, knock out a few kids, live a few streets away from where I had always lived. Apart from an exotic taste in clothes and the fact that I'm a bit short, there's not a lot separating me from anyone you might pass in the street. You probably wouldn't look at me twice. An ordinary girl leading an ordinary life. It actually suited me fine. "You must wear a suit to an interview," Mum had insisted. "Everyone's far too casual these days. Because wearing pinstripes will be vital if I'm spoon-feeding a geriatric. Don't be smart." "I can't afford to buy a suit. What if I don't get the job?" "You can wear mine, and I'll iron you a nice blouse. And just for once, don't wear your hair up in those..." She gestured to my hair, which was normally twisted into two dark knots on each side of my head. "Princess Leia things. Just try to look like a normal person." I knew better than to argue with my mother. And I could tell Dad had been instructed not to comment on my outfit as I walked out of the house, my gait awkward in the too tight skirt.
"Bye, love,"
he said, the corners of his mouth twitching.
"Good luck now. You look very business-like."
The embarrassing thing was not that I was wearing my mother's suit, or that it was in a cut last fashionable in the late 1980s, but that it was actually a tiny bit small for me. I felt the waistband cutting into my midriff and pulled the double-breasted jacket across. As Dad says of Mum, there's more fat on a Kirby grip. I sat through the short bus journey feeling faintly sick. I had never had a proper job interview. I had joined the buttered bun after Trina bet me that I couldn't get a job in a day. I had walked in and simply asked Frank if he needed a spare pair of hands. It had been his first day open, and he had looked almost blinded by gratitude. Now, looking back, I couldn't even remember having a discussion with him about money. He suggested a weekly wage, I agreed, and once a year he told me he'd upped it a bit, usually by a little more than I would have asked for. What did people ask in interviews anyway? And what if they asked me to do something practical with this old man, to feed him or bath him or something? Saeed had said there was a male carer who covered his intimate needs. I shuddered at the phrase. The secondary carer's job was, he said, a little unclear at this point. I pictured myself wiping drool from the old man's mouth, maybe asking loudly,
Did he want a cup of tea?
When Grandad had first begun his recovery from his strokes, he hadn't been able to do anything for himself. Mum had done it all.
Your mother is a saint, Dad said, which I took to mean that she wiped his bum without running screaming from the house. I was pretty sure nobody had ever described me as such. I cut Grandad's food up for him, and I made him cups of tea, but as for anything else, I wasn't sure I was made of the right ingredients. Granter House was on the other side of Stortford Castle, close to the medieval walls, on the long, unpavemented stretch that housed only four houses and the National Trust shop, bang in the middle of the tourist area. I had passed this house a million times in my life without ever actually properly seeing it. Now, walking past the car park and the miniature railway, both of which were empty and as bleak as only a summer attraction can look in February, I saw it was bigger than I had imagined. Red brick with a double front, the kind of house you saw in old copies of Country Life while waiting at the doctor's. I walked up the long drive, trying not to think about whether anybody was watching out of the window. Walking up a long drive puts you at a disadvantage. It automatically makes you feel inferior. I was just contemplating whether to actually tug at my forelock when the door opened and I jumped. A woman not much older than me stepped out into the porch. She was wearing white slacks and a medical-looking tunic, and carried a coat and a folder under her arm. As she passed me, she gave a polite smile.
"And thank you so much for coming," a voice said from inside. "We'll be in touch."
"Ah."
A woman's face appeared, middle-aged but beautiful, under expensive precision-cut hair. She was wearing a trouser suit that I guessed cost more than my dad earned in a month.
"You must be Miss Clark."
"Louisa." I shot out a hand, as my mother had impressed upon me to do. The young people never offered up a hand these days, my parents had agreed. In the old days you wouldn't have dreamt of a hire, or worse, an air kiss. This woman did not look like she would have welcomed an air kiss.
"Right, yes, do come in."
She withdrew her hand from mine as soon as humanly possible, but I felt her eyes linger upon me, as if she were already assessing me.
"Would you like to come through? We'll talk in the drawing room. My name is Camilla Traynor."
She seemed weary, as if she had uttered the same words many times that day already. I followed her through to a huge room with floor-to-ceiling French windows. Heavy curtains draped elegantly from fat mahogany curtain poles, and the floors were carpeted with intricately decorated Persian rugs. It smelt of beeswax and antique furniture. There were little elegant side tables everywhere, their burnished surfaces covered with ornamental boxes. I wondered briefly where on earth the trainers put their cups of tea.
"So you have come via the job centre advertisement, is that right? Do sit down."
While she flicked through her folder of papers, I gazed surreptitiously around the room. I had thought the house might be a bit like a care home, all hoists and white clean surfaces. But this was like one of those scarily expensive hotels, steeped in old money, with well-loved things that looked valuable in their own right. There were silver-framed photographs on a sideboard, but they were too far away for me to make out the faces. As she scanned her pages, I shifted in my seat to try to get a better look. And it was then that I heard it. The unmistakable sound of stitches ripping. I glanced down to see the two pieces of material that joined at the side of my right leg had torn apart,
sending frayed pieces of silk thread shooting upwards in an ungainly fringe. I felt my face flood with colour.
So, Miss Clark, do you have any experience with quadriplegia?
I turned to face Mrs. Traynor, wriggling so that my jacket covered as much of the skirt as possible.
No.
Have you been a carer for long?
I've never actually done it,
I said, adding as if I could hear Saeed's voice in my ear.
But I'm sure I could learn.
Do you know what a quadriplegic is? I faltered.
When you're stuck in a wheelchair?
I suppose that's one way of putting it. There are varying degrees, but in this case we are talking about complete loss of use of the legs and a very limited use of the hands and arms. Would that bother you?
Well, not as much as it would bother him, obviously.
I raised a smile, but Mrs. Traynor's face was expressionless.
Sorry, I didn't mean...
Can you drive, Miss Clark?
Yes.
Clean license?
I nodded.
Camilla Traynor ticked something on her list. The rip was growing. I could see it creeping inexorably up my thigh. At this rate, by the time I stood up, I would look like a Vegas showgirl.
Are you all right?
Mrs. Traynor was gazing at me.
I'm just a little warm. Do you mind if I take my jacket off?
Before she could say anything, I wrenched the jacket off in one fluid motion and tied it around my waist, obscuring the split in the skirt.
Oh, so hot, I said, smiling at her. Coming in from outside, you know.
There was the faintest pause, and then Mrs. Traynor looked back at her folder.
How old are you?
I'm 26.
And you were in your previous job for 6 years?
Yes. You should have a copy of my reference. Mrs. Traynor held it up and squinted.
Your previous employer says you are a warm, chatty, and life-enhancing presence.
Yes, I paid him. That poker face again. Oh, hell, I thought. It was as if I were being studied, not necessarily in a good way. My mother's shirt felt suddenly cheap, the synthetic threads shining in the thin light. I should just have worn my plainest trousers and a shirt, anything but this suit.
So why are you leaving this job, where you are clearly so well regarded?
Frank, the owner, sold the cafe. It's the one at the bottom of the castle, the Buttered Bun. Oh, was, I corrected myself. I would have been happy to stay.
Mrs. Traynor nodded, either because she didn't feel the need to say anything further about it, or because she too would have been happy for me to stay there.
And what exactly do you want to do with your life?
I'm sorry?
Do you have aspirations for a career? Would this be a stepping stone to something else? Do you have a professional dream that you wish to pursue?
I looked at her blankly. Was this some kind of trick question?
I haven't really thought that far. Since I lost my job, I swallowed. I just want to work again.
It sounded feeble. What kind of person came to an interview without even knowing what she wanted to do?
Mrs. Traynor's expression suggested she thought the same thing. She put down her pen.
So, Miss Clark, why should I employ you
instead of, say, the previous candidate, who has several years' experience with quadriplegics. I looked at her. Honestly, I don't know. This met with silence, so I added, I guess that would be your call. You can't give me a single reason why I should employ you. My mother's face suddenly swam into view. The thought of going home with a ruined suit and another interview failure was beyond me, and this job paid more than £9 an hour. I sat up a bit. Well, I'm a fast learner, I'm never ill, I only live on the other side of the castle, and I'm stronger than I look. Probably strong enough to help move your husband around. My husband? It's not my husband you'd be working with. It's my son. Your son? I blinked. I'm not afraid of hard work. I'm good at dealing with all sorts of people, and I make a mean cup of tea. I began to blather into the silence. The thought of it being her son had thrown me. I mean, my dad seems to think that's not the greatest reference, but in my experience there's not much that can't be fixed by a decent cup of tea. There was something a bit strange about the way Mrs. Trainor was looking at me. Sorry, I spluttered as I realised what I had said. I'm not suggesting the thing, the paraplegia, quadriplegia with your son could be solved by a cup of tea. I should tell you, Miss Clark, that this is not a permanent contract. It would be for a maximum of 6 months. That is why the salary is commensurate. We wanted to attract the right person. Believe me, when you've done shifts at a chicken processing factory, working in Guantanamo Bay for 6 months looks attractive. Oh, shut up, Louisa. I bit my lip. But Mrs. Trainor seemed oblivious. She closed her file. My son, Will, was injured in a road accident almost 2 years ago. He requires 24-hour care, the majority of which is provided by a trained nurse. I have recently returned to work, and the carer would be required to be here throughout the day to keep him company, help him with food and drink, generally provide an extra pair of hands, and make sure that he comes to no harm. Camilla Trainor looked down at her lap. It is of the utmost importance that Will has someone here who understands that responsibility. Everything she said, even the way she emphasized her words, seemed to hint at some stupidity on my part. I can see that. I began to gather up my bag. So would you like the job? It was so unexpected that at first I thought I had heard her wrong. Sorry? We would need you to start as soon as possible. Payment will be weekly. I was briefly lost for words. You'd rather have me instead of... I began. The hours are quite lengthy. 8 a.m. till 5 p.m, sometimes later. There is no lunch break as such, although when Nathan, his daily nurse, comes in at lunchtime to attend to him, there should be a free half an hour. You wouldn't need anything medical. Will has all the medical care we can offer him. What we want for him is somebody robust and upbeat. His life is complicated, and it is important that he is encouraged to... She broke off, her gaze fixed on something outside the French windows. Finally, she turned back to me. Well, Let's just say that his mental welfare is as important to us as his physical welfare. Do you understand?
I think so. Would I wear a uniform?
No. Definitely no uniform.
She glanced at my legs.
Although you might want to wear something a bit less revealing.
I glanced down to where my jacket had shifted, revealing a generous expanse of bare thigh. I'm sorry, it ripped. It's not actually mine.
But Mrs. Traynor no longer appeared to be listening. I'll explain what needs doing when you start. Will is not the easiest person to be around at the moment, Miss Clark. This job is going to be about mental attitude, as much as any professional skills you might have. So, we will see you tomorrow?
Tomorrow? You don't want me to meet him?
Will is not having a good day. I think it's best that we start afresh then.
I stood up, realizing Mrs. Traynor was already waiting to see me out. Yes, I said, tugging Mum's jacket across me. Thank you. I'll see you at 8 o'clock tomorrow. Mum was spooning potatoes onto Dad's plate. She put two on. He parried, lifting a third and fourth from the serving dish. She blocked him, steering them back onto the serving dish, finally rapping him on the knuckles with the serving spoon when he made for them again. Around the little table sat my parents, my sister and Thomas, my granddad, and Patrick, who always came for dinner on Wednesdays. Daddy, Mum said to Grandad, would you like someone to cut your meat? Trina, will you cut Daddy's meat? Trina leant across and began slicing at Grandad's plate with deft strokes. On the other side, she had already done the same for Thomas. So how messed up is this man, Lou?
Can't be up to much if they're willing to let our daughter loose on him, Bernard remarked.
Behind me, the television was on, so that Dad and Patrick could watch the football. Every now and then they would stop, peering round me, their mouths stopping mid-chew as they watched some pass or near miss.
I think it's a great opportunity. She'll be working in one of the big houses, for a good family. Are they posh, love?
In our street, posh could mean anyone who hadn't got a family member in possession of an Asbo. I suppose so.
Have you practiced your curtsy?
Dad grinned. Did you actually meet him? Trina leant across to stop Thomas elbowing his juice onto the floor. The crippled man. What was he like? I meet him tomorrow. Weird, though. You'll be spending all day every day with him. 9 hours. You'll see him more than you see Patrick. That's not hard, I said. Patrick, across the table, pretended he couldn't hear me.
Still, you won't have to worry about the old sexual harassment, eh?
Dad said.
Bernard,
said my mother sharply.
I'm only saying what everyone's thinking. Probably the best boss you could find for your girlfriend, eh, Patrick?
Across the table, Patrick smiled. He was busy refusing potatoes, despite Mum's best efforts. He was having a non-carb month, ready for a marathon in early March. You know, I was thinking, will you have to learn sign language? I mean, if he can't communicate, how will you know what he wants? She didn't say he couldn't talk, Mum. I couldn't actually remember what Mrs. Traynor had said. I was still vaguely in shock at actually having been given a job.
Maybe he talks through one of those devices. Like that scientist bloke, the one on The Simpsons.
Bugger, said Thomas.
No,
said Bernard.
Stephen Hawking,
said Patrick. That's you, that is, Mum said, looking accusingly from Thomas to Dad. She could cut steak with that look, teaching him bad language.
It is not. I don't know where he's getting it from.
Bugger,
said Thomas, looking directly at his grandfather. Trina made a face.
I think it would freak me out if he talked through one of those voice boxes. Can you imagine? Get me a drink of water, she mimicked.
Bright, but not bright enough not to get herself up the duff, as Dad occasionally muttered. She had been the first member of our family to go to university, until Thomas's arrival had caused her to drop out during her final year. Mum and Dad still held out hopes that one day she would bring the family a fortune, or possibly work in a place with a reception desk that didn't have a security screen around it. Either would do.
Why would being in a wheelchair mean he had to speak like a Dalek? I said.
But you're going to have to get up close and personal to him. At the very least, you'll have to wipe his mouth and give him drinks and stuff.
So, it's hardly rocket science, says the woman who used to put Thomas's nappy on inside out. That was once. Twice, and you only changed him three times.
I helped myself to green beans, trying to look more sanguine than I felt. But even as I had ridden the bus home, the same thoughts had already started buzzing around my head. What would we talk about? What if he just stared at me, head lolling all day? Would I be freaked out? What if I couldn't understand what it was he wanted? I was legendarily bad at caring for things. We no longer had houseplants at home, or pets after the disasters that were the hamster, the stick insects, and Randolph the goldfish. And how often was that stiff mother of his going to be around? I didn't like the thought of being watched all the time. Mrs. Trainer seemed like the kind of woman whose gaze turned capable hands into fingers and thumbs.
Patrick, what do you think of it all, then?
Patrick took a long slug of water and shrugged. Outside, the rain beat on the window panes, just audible over the clatter of plates and cutlery.
It's good money, Bernard. Better than working nights at the chicken factory, anyway.
There was a general murmur of agreement around the table.
Well, it comes to something when the best you can all say about my new career is that it's better than hauling chicken carcasses around the inside of an aircraft hangar, I said.
Well, you could always get fit in the meantime and go and do some of your personal training stuff with Patrick here.
Get fit? Thanks, Dad.
I had been about to reach for another potato and now changed my mind.
Well, why not?
Mum looked as if she might actually sit down. Everyone paused briefly. But no, she was up again, helping Grandad to some gravy.
It might be worth bearing in mind for the future. You've certainly got the gift of the gab.
She has the gift of the flab,
Dad snorted.
I've just got myself a job, I said. Paying more than the last one, too, if you don't mind.
But it is only temporary,
Patrick interjected.
Your dad's right. You might want to start getting in shape while you do it. You could be a good personal trainer if you put in a bit of effort.
I don't want to be a personal trainer. I don't fancy all that bouncing.
I mouthed an insult at Patrick, who grinned.
What Lou wants is a job where she can put her feet up and watch daytime telly while feeding old Ironside there through a straw, said Trina. Yes, because rearranging limp dahlias into buckets of water requires so much physical and mental effort, doesn't it, Treen?
We're teasing you, love.
Dad raised his mug of tea.
It's great that you've got a job. We're proud of you already. And I bet you, once you slide those feet of yours under the table at the big house, those buggers won't want to get rid of you.
Bugger, said Thomas.
Not me, said Dad, chewing, before Mum could say a thing.
Chapter 3. This is the annex. It used to be stables, but we realised it would suit Will rather better than the house, as it's all on one floor. This is the spare room, so that Nathan can stay over if necessary. We needed someone quite often in the early days. Mrs. Traynor walked briskly down the corridor, gesturing from one doorway to the other without looking back, her high heels clacking on the flagstones. There seemed to be an expectation that I would keep up. The keys to the car are here. I've put you on our insurance. I'm trusting the details you gave me were correct. Nathan should be able to show you how the ramp works. All you have to do is help Will position properly, and the vehicle will do the rest. Although he's not desperately keen to go anywhere at the moment. It is a bit chilly out, I said. Mrs. Traynor didn't seem to hear me. You can make yourself tea and coffee in the kitchen. I keep the cupboards stocked. The bathroom is through here. She opened the door, and I stared at the white metal and plastic hoist that crouched over the bath. There was an open wet area under the shower, with a folded wheelchair beside it. In the corner, a glass-fronted cabinet revealed neat stacks of shrink-wrapped bales. I couldn't see what they were from here, but it all gave off a faint scent of disinfectant. Mrs. Traynor closed the door and turned briefly to face me. I should reiterate, it is very important that Will has someone with him all the time. A previous carer disappeared for several hours once to get her car fixed, and Will injured himself in her absence. She swallowed, as if still traumatized by the memory. I won't go anywhere. Of course, you will need comfort breaks. I just want to make it clear that he can't be left for periods longer than, say, 10 or 15 minutes. If something unavoidable comes up, either ring the intercom, as my husband Stephen may be home, or call my mobile number. If you do need to take any time off, I would appreciate as much notice as possible. It is not always easy finding cover. No. Mrs. Traynor opened the hall cupboard. She spoke like someone reciting a well-rehearsed speech. I wondered briefly how many carers there had been before me. If Will is occupied, then it would be helpful if you could do some basic housekeeping. Wash bedding, run a vacuum cleaner around, that sort of thing. The cleaning equipment is under the sink. He may not want you around him all the time. You and he will have to work out your level of interaction for yourselves. Mrs. Traynor looked at my clothes as if for the first time. I was wearing the very shaggy waistcoat thing that Dad says makes me look like an emu. I tried to smile. It seemed like an effort. Obviously, I would hope that you could get on with each other. It would be nice if he could think of you as a friend rather than a paid professional. Right. What does he, like to do? He watches films. Sometimes he listens to the radio or to music. He has one of those digital things. If you position it near his hand, he can usually manipulate it himself. He has some movement in his fingers, although he finds it hard to grip. I felt myself brightening. If he liked music and films, surely we could find some common ground. I had a sudden picture of myself and this man laughing at some Hollywood comedy, me running the Hoover around the bedroom while he listened to his music. Perhaps this was going to be okay. Perhaps we might end up as friends. I had never had a disabled friend before. Only Treen's friend David, who was deaf, but would put you in a headlock if you suggested that meant disabled.
Do you have any questions?
No.
Then let's go and introduce you.
She glanced at her watch.
Nathan should have finished dressing him now.
We hesitated outside the door, and Mrs. Traynor knocked.
Are you in there? I have Miss Clark to meet you, Will.
There was no answer.
Will? Nathan?
A broad New Zealand accent.
He's decent, Mrs. T.
She pushed open the door. The annex's living room was deceptively large, and one wall consisted entirely of glass doors that looked out over open countryside. A wood burner glowed quietly in the corner, and a low beige sofa faced a huge flat-screen television, its seats covered by a wool throw. The mood of the room was tasteful and peaceful, a Scandinavian bachelor pad. In the centre of the room stood a black wheelchair, its seat and back cushioned by sheepskin. A solidly built man in white collarless scrubs was crouching down, adjusting a man's feet on the footrests of the wheelchair. As we stepped into the room, the man in the wheelchair looked up from under shaggy, unkempt hair. His eyes met mine, and after a pause, he let out a blood-curdling groan. Then his mouth twisted, and he let out another unearthly cry. I felt his mother stiffen.
Will, stop it!
He didn't even glance towards her. Another prehistoric sound emerged from somewhere near his chest. It was a terrible, agonizing noise. I tried not to flinch. The man was grimacing, his head tilted and sunk into his shoulders as he stared at me through contorted features. He looked grotesque and vaguely angry. I realized that where I held my bag, my knuckles had turned white.
Will, please!
There was a faint note of hysteria in his mother's voice.
Please, don't do this!
Oh, God, I thought. I'm not up to this. I swallowed hard. The man was still staring at me. He seemed to be waiting for me to do something.
I'm Lou.
My voice, uncharacteristically tremulous, broke into the silence. I wondered briefly whether to hold out a hand, and then, remembering that he wouldn't be able to take it, gave a feeble wave instead.
Short for Louisa.
Then, to my astonishment, his features cleared, and his head straightened on his shoulders. Will Traynor gazed at me steadily, the faintest of smiles flickering across his face.
"Good morning, Miss Clark," he said. "I hear you're my latest minder."
Nathan had finished adjusting the footrests. He shook his head as he stood up.
"You are a bad man, Mr. T. Very bad."
He grinned and held out a broad hand, which I shook limply. Nathan exuded an air of unflappability.
"I'm afraid you just got Will's best Christy Brown impression. You'll get used to him. His bark is worse than his bite."
Mrs. Traynor was holding the cross at her neck with slim white fingers. She moved it backwards and forwards along its thin gold chain, a nervous habit. Her face was rigid.
"I'll leave you all to get on. You can call through using the intercom if you need any help. Nathan will take you through Will's routines and his equipment."
"I'm here, Mother. You don't have to talk across me. My brain isn't paralysed. Yet."
"Yes, well, if you're going to be foul, Will, I think it's best if Miss Clark does talk directly to Nathan."
His mother wouldn't look at him as she spoke, I noticed. She kept her gaze about 10 feet away on the floor.
I'm working from home today, so I'll pop in at lunchtime, Miss Clark.
Okay.
My voice emerged as a squawk. Mrs. Traynor disappeared. We were silent while we listened to her clipped footsteps disappearing down the hall towards the main house. Then Nathan broke the silence.
You mind if I go and talk Miss Clark through your meds, Will? You want the television? Some music?
Radio 4, please, Nathan.
Sure thing.
We walked through to the kitchen.
You not had much experience with quadriplegics, Miss T says?
No.
Okay, I'll keep it fairly simple for today. There's a folder here that tells you pretty much everything you need to know about Will's routines and all his emergency numbers. I'd advise you to read it if you get a spare moment. I'm guessing you'll have a few.
Nathan took a key from his belt and opened a locked cabinet, which was packed full of boxes and small plastic canisters of medication.
Right. This lot is mostly my bag, but you do need to know where everything is in case of emergencies. There's a timetable there on the wall, so you can see what he has when on a daily basis. Any extras you give him, you mark in there, he pointed. But you're best to clear anything through Mrs. T, at least at this stage.
I didn't realise I was going to have to handle drugs.
It's not hard. He mostly knows what he needs, but he might need a little help getting them down. We tend to use this beaker here. Or you can crush them with this pestle and mortar and put them in a drink.
I picked up one of the labels. I wasn't sure I had ever seen so many drugs outside a pharmacy.
Okay, so he has two meds for blood pressure, this to lower it at bedtime, this one to raise it when he gets out of bed. These he needs fairly often to control his muscular spasms. You will need to give him one mid-morning and again at mid-afternoon. He doesn't find those too hard to swallow because they're the little coated ones. These are for bladder spasms, and these here are for acid reflux. He sometimes needs these after eating if he gets uncomfortable. This is his antihistamine for the morning, and these are his nasal sprays, but I mostly do those last thing before I leave, so you shouldn't have to worry. He can have paracetamol if he's in pain, and he does have the odd sleeping pill, but these tend to make him more irritable in the daytime, so we try to restrict them. These, he held up another bottle, are the antibiotics he has every 2 weeks for his catheter change. I do those unless I'm away, in which case I'll leave clear instructions. They're pretty strong. There are the boxes of rubber gloves if you need to clean him up at all. There's also cream there if he gets sore, but he's been pretty good since we got the air mattress.
As I stood there, he reached into his pocket and handed another key to me.
This is the spare, he said. Not to be given to anyone else, not even Will, okay? Guard it with your life.
It's a lot to remember, I swallowed.
It's all written down. All you need to remember for today are his antispasm meds, those ones. There's my mobile number if you need to call me. I'm studying when I'm not here, so I'd rather not be called too often, but feel free till you feel confident.
I stared at the folder in front of me. I felt like I was about to sit an exam I hadn't prepared for. What if he needs to go to the loo? I thought of the hoist. I'm not sure I could, you know, lift him. I tried not to let my face betray my panic. Nathan shook his head.
You don't need to do any of that. His catheter takes care of that. I'll be in at lunchtime to change it all. You're not here for the physical stuff.
What am I here for? Nathan studied the floor before he looked at me.
Try to cheer him up a little. He's He's a little cranky. Understandable given the circumstances, but you're going to have a fairly thick skin. That little skit this morning is his way of getting you off balance.
Is this why the pay is so good?
Ah, yes. No such thing as a free lunch, eh?
Nathan clapped me on the shoulder. I felt my body reverberate with it.
Ah, he's all right. You don't have to pussyfoot around him.
He hesitated.
I like him.
He said it like he might be the only person who did. I followed him back into the living room. Will Traynor's chair had moved to the window, and he had his back to us and was staring out, listening to something on the radio.
That's me done, Will. You want anything before I go?
No. Thank you, Nathan.
I'll leave you in Miss Clark's capable hands, then. See you lunchtime, mate.
I watched the affable helper putting on his jacket with a rising sense of panic.
Have fun, you guys.
Nathan winked at me, and then he was gone. I stood in the middle of the room, hands thrust in my pockets, unsure what to do. Will Traynor continued to stare out of the window as if I weren't there.
Would you like me to make you a cup of tea?
I said finally, when the silence became unbearable.
Ah, yes, the girl who makes tea for a living. I wondered how long it would be before you wanted to show off your skills. No, no thank you.
Coffee, then?
No hot beverages for me just now, Miss Clark.
You can call me Lou.
Will it help?
I blinked, my mouth opening briefly. I closed it. Dad always said it made me look more stupid than I actually was.
Well, can I get you anything?
He turned to look at me. His jaw was covered in several weeks of stubble, and his eyes were unreadable. He turned away. I cast around the room.
I'll see if there's any washing then.
I walked out of the room, my heart thumping. From the safety of the kitchen, I pulled out my mobile phone and thumped out a message to my sister.
This is awful. He hates me.
The reply came back within seconds.
You have only been there an hour, you wuss. Mum and Dad really worried about money. Just get a grip and think of hourly rate. Kiss.
I snapped my mobile phone shut and blew out my cheeks. I went through the laundry basket in the bathroom, managing to raise a paltry quarter load of washing, and spent some minutes checking the instructions to the machine. I didn't want to misprogram it or do anything which might prompt Will or Mrs. Traynor to look at me like I was stupid again. I started the washing machine and stood there, trying to work out what else I could legitimately do. I pulled the vacuum cleaner from the hall cupboard and ran it up and down the corridor and into the two bedrooms, thinking all the while that if my parents could see me, they would have insisted on taking a commemorative photograph. The spare bedroom was almost empty, like a hotel room. I suspected Nathan did not stay over often. I thought I probably couldn't blame him. I hesitated outside Will Traynor's bedroom, then reasoned that it needed hoovering just like anywhere else. There was a built-in shelf unit along one side, upon which sat around 20 framed photographs. As I hoovered around the bed, I allowed myself a quick peek at them. There was a man bungee jumping from a cliff, his arms outstretched like a statue of Christ. There was a man who might have been Will in what looked like jungle, and him again in the midst of a group of drunken friends.
The men wore bow ties and dinner jackets and had their arms around each other's shoulders. There he was on a ski slope beside a girl with dark glasses and long blonde hair. I stooped to get a better view of him in his ski goggles. He was clean-shaven in the photograph, and even in the bright light, his face had that expensive sheen to it that moneyed people get through going on holiday 3 times a year. He had broad, muscular shoulders, visible even through his ski jacket. I put the photograph carefully back on the table and continued to vacuum around the back of the bed. Finally, I turned the vacuum cleaner off and began to wind the cord up. As I reached down to unplug it, I caught a movement in the corner of my eye and jumped, letting out a small shriek. Will Traynor was in the doorway, watching me.
Courcheval, 2.5 years ago.
I blushed. I'm sorry, I was just...
You were just looking at my photographs, wondering how awful it must be to live like that and then turn into a cripple.
No. I blushed even more furiously.
The rest of my photographs are in the bottom drawer if you find yourself overcome with curiosity again, he said.
And then with a low hum, the wheelchair turned to the right and he disappeared. The morning sagged and decided to last for several years. I couldn't remember the last time minutes and hours stretched so interminably. I tried to find as many jobs to occupy myself as I could and went into the living room as seldom as possible, knowing I was being cowardly but not really caring. At 11, I brought Will Traynor a beaker of water and his anti-spasm medication, as Nathan had requested. I placed the pill on his tongue and then offered him the beaker, as Nathan had instructed me. It was pale, opaque plastic, the kind of thing Thomas had used, except without Bob the Builder on the sides. He swallowed with some effort and then signalled to me that I should leave him alone. I dusted some shelves that didn't really need dusting and contemplated cleaning some windows. Around me, the annex was silent, apart from the low hum of the television in the living room where he sat. I didn't feel confident enough to put on a music station in the kitchen. I had a feeling he would have something cutting to say about my choice in music. At 12:30, Nathan arrived, bringing with him the cold air of outside and a raised eyebrow.
"All okay?"
he said. I had rarely been so happy to see someone in my life.
Fine. Great. You can take a half hour now. Me and Mr. T have a few things we attend to at this point in the day.
I almost ran for my coat. I hadn't planned on going out for lunch, but I was almost faint with relief at getting out of that house. I pulled up my collar, stuck my handbag on my shoulder, and set off at a brisk walk down the drive, as if I had somewhere I actually wanted to go. In fact, I just walked around the surrounding streets for half an hour, breathing hot clouds of breath into my tightly wrapped scarf. There were no cafes at this end of town, now that the Buttered Bun was closed. The castle was deserted. The nearest eating place was a gastropub, the kind of place where I doubted I could afford a drink, let alone a quick lunch. All the cars in the car park were huge and expensive with recent number plates. I stood in the castle car park, making sure I was out of view of Granter House, and dialed my sister's number.
Hey. You know I can't talk at work. You haven't walked out, have you?
No, I just needed to hear a friendly voice.
Is he that bad?
Treen, he hates me. He looks at me like I'm something the cat dragged in, and he doesn't even drink tea. I'm hiding from him.
I can't believe I'm hearing this.
What?
Just talk to him, for crying out loud. Of course he's miserable. He's stuck in a bloody wheelchair. And you're probably being useless. Just talk to him. Get to know him. What's the worst that can happen?
I don't know. I don't know if I can stick it.
I'm not telling Mum you're giving up your job after half a day. They won't give you any benefits, Lou. You can't do this. We can't afford for you to do this.
She was right. I realised I hated my sister. There was a brief silence. Treen's voice turned uncharacteristically conciliatory. This was really worrying. It meant she knew I did actually have the worst job in the world.
Look, she said. It's just 6 months. Just do the 6 months, have something useful on your CV, and you can get a job you actually like. And hey, look at it this way. At least it's not working nights at the chicken factory, right?
Nights at the chicken factory would feel like a holiday compared with...
I'm going now, Lou. I'll see you later.
So, would you like to go somewhere this afternoon? We could drive somewhere, if you like.
Nathan had been gone for almost half an hour. I had spun out the washing of the tea mugs as long as humanly possible, and I thought that if I spent one more hour in this silent house, my head might explode. He turned his head towards me.
Where did you have in mind?
I don't know. Just a drive in the country? I was doing this thing I sometimes do of pretending I'm Trina. She is one of those people who are completely calm and competent, and as a result no one ever messes with her. I sounded to my own ears professional and upbeat.
The country, he said, as if considering it. And what would we see? Some trees? Some sky?
I don't know. What do you normally do?
I don't do anything, Miss Clark. I can't do anything anymore. I sit. I just about exist.
Well, I said, I was told that you have a car that's adapted for wheelchair use.
And you're worried that it will stop working if it doesn't get used every day?
No, but I...
Are you telling me I should go out?
I just thought...
You thought a little drive would be good for me. A breath of fresh air.
I'm just trying to...
Miss Clark, my life is not going to be significantly improved by a drive around Stortfold's country lanes.
He turned away. His head had sunk into his shoulders, and I wondered whether he was comfortable. It didn't seem to be the time to ask him. We sat in silence. Do you want me to bring you your computer?
Why? Have you thought of a good quadriplegic support group I could join? Quads R Us? The Tin Wheel Club?
I took a deep breath, trying to make my voice sound confident.
Okay, well, seeing as we're going to spend all this time in each other's company, perhaps we could get to know something about each other. There was something about his face then that made me falter. He was staring straight ahead at the wall, a tick moving in his jaw. It's just... It's quite a long time to spend with someone. All day, I continued. Perhaps if you could tell me a little of what you want to do, what you like, then I can make sure things are as you like them. This time the silence was painful. I heard my voice slowly swallowed by it, and couldn't work out what to do with my hands. Trina and her competent manner had evaporated. Finally, The wheelchair hummed, and he turned slowly to face me.
"Here's what I know about you, Miss Clark. My mother says you're chatty."
He said it like it was an affliction.
"Can we strike a deal whereby you are very unchatty around me?"
I swallowed, feeling my face flame.
"Fine,"
I said when I could speak again.
"I'll be in the kitchen. If you want anything, just call me."
"You can't give up already." I was lying sideways on my bed with my legs stretched up the wall like I did when I was a teenager. I had been up here since supper, which was unusual for me. Since Thomas was born, he and Trina had moved into the bigger room, and I was in the box room, which was small enough to make you feel claustrophobic should you sit in it for more than half an hour at a time. But I didn't want to sit downstairs with Mum and Grandad, because Mum kept looking at me anxiously and saying things like, "It will get better, love," and "No job is great on the first day," as if she'd had a ruddy job in the last 20 years. It was making me feel guilty, and I hadn't even done anything. I didn't say I was giving up. Trina had barged in without knocking, as she did every day, even though I always had to knock quietly on her room in case Thomas was sleeping. And I could have been naked. You could at least shout first. "I've seen worse. Mum thinks you're going to hand in your notice." I slid my leg sideways down the wall and pushed myself up to a seated position. "Oh, God, Treen, it's worse than I thought. He is so miserable. He can't move. Of course he's miserable." "No, but he's sarcastic and mean with it. Every time I say something or suggest something, he looks at me like I'm stupid or says something that makes me feel about 2 years old." "You probably did say something stupid. You just need to get used to each other." "I really didn't. I was so careful. I hardly said anything except, 'Would you like to go out for a drive?' or 'Would you like a cup of tea?'" "Well, maybe he's like that with everyone at the start, until he knows whether you're going to stick around. I bet they get through loads of helpers. He didn't even want me in the same room as him. Oh, I don't think I can stick it, Katrina. I really don't. Honest, if you'd been there, you would understand." Trina said nothing then, just looked at me for a while. She got up and glanced out of the door, as if checking whether there was anybody on the landing. "I'm thinking of going back to college," she said finally. It took my brain a few seconds to register this change of tack. "Oh, my God," I said. "But I'm going to take a loan to pay for the fees. But I can get some special grant, too, because of having Thomas. And the university is offering me reduced rates because they..." She shrugged, a little embarrassed. "They say they think I could excel. Someone's dropped out of the business studies course, so they can take me for the beginning of the next term." "What about Thomas?" "There's a nursery on campus. We can stay there in a subsidised flat in halls in the week and come back here most weekends." "Oh." I could feel her watching me. I didn't know what to do with my face. "I'm really desperate to use my brain again. Doing the flowers is doing my head in. I want to learn. I want to improve myself. And I'm sick of my hands always being freezing cold from the water." We both stared at her hands, which were pink-tinged, even in the tropical warmth of our house. "But, yep, I won't be working, Lou. I won't be able to give Mum anything. I might even need a bit of help from them." This time she looked quite uncomfortable.
Her expression, when she glanced up at me, was almost apologetic. Downstairs, Mum was laughing at something on the television. We could hear her exclaiming to Grandad. She often explained the plot of the show to him, even though we told her all the time she didn't need to. I couldn't speak. The significance of my sister's words sank in slowly but inexorably. I felt like a mafia victim must do, watching the concrete setting slowly around their ankles. I really need to do this, Lou. I want more for Thomas, more for both of us. The only way I'll get anywhere is by going back to college. I haven't got a Patrick. I'm not sure I'll ever have a Patrick, given that nobody's been remotely interested since I had Thomas. I need to do the best I can by myself. When I didn't say anything, she added, "For me and Thomas." I nodded. "Lou, please." I had never seen my sister look like that before. It made me feel really uncomfortable. I lifted my head and raised a smile. My voice, when it emerged, didn't even sound like my own. "Well, like you say, it's just a matter of getting used to him. It's bound to be difficult in the first few days, isn't it?" To 4. 2 weeks passed, and with them emerged a routine of sorts. Every morning I would arrive at Granter House at 8, call out that I was there, and then, after Nathan had finished helping Will dress, listen carefully while he told me what I needed to know about Will's meds, or more importantly, his mood. After Nathan had left, I would program the radio or television for Will, dispense his pills, sometimes crushing them with the little marble pestle and mortar. Usually, after 10 minutes or so, he would make it clear that he was weary of my presence. At this point, I would eke out the little annex's domestic tasks, washing tea towels that weren't dirty, or using random vacuum attachments to clean tiny bits of skirting or windowsill, religiously popping my head round the door every 15 minutes, as Mrs. Traynor had instructed. When I did, he would be sitting in his chair, looking out into the bleak garden. Later, I might take him a drink of water, or one of the calorie-filled drinks that were supposed to keep his weight up and looked like pastel-coloured wallpaper paste, or give him his food. He could move his hands a little, but not his arm, so he had to be fed forkful by forkful. This was the worst part of the day. It seemed wrong somehow, spoon-feeding a grown man, and my embarrassment made me clumsy and awkward. Will hated it so much he wouldn't even meet my eye while I was doing it. And then shortly before 1, Nathan would arrive, and I would grab my coat and disappear to walk the streets, sometimes eating my lunch in the bus shelter outside the castle. It was cold, and I probably looked pathetic perched there eating my sandwiches. But I didn't care. I couldn't spend a whole day in that house. In the afternoon, I would put a film on. Will had a membership of a DVD club, and new films arrived by post every day. But he never invited me to watch with him, so I'd usually go and sit in the kitchen or in the spare room. I started bringing in a book or magazine, but I felt oddly guilty not actually working, and I could never quite concentrate on the words. Occasionally, at the end of the day, Mrs. Traynor would pop in, although she never said much to me, other than, "Everything all right?" To which the only acceptable answer seemed to be, "Yes." She would ask Will if he wanted anything, occasionally suggest something he might like to do tomorrow, some outing or some friend who had asked after him, and he would almost always answer dismissively, if not with downright rudeness.
She would look pained, run her fingers up and down that little gold chain, and disappear again. His father, a well-padded, gentle-looking man, usually came in as I was leaving. He was the kind of man you might see watching cricket in a Panama hat, and had apparently overseen the management of the castle since retiring from his well-paid job in the city. I suspected this was like a benign landowner digging in the odd potato just to keep his hand in. He finished every day at 5 p.m. promptly, and would sit and watch television with Will. Sometimes I heard him making some remark about whatever was on the news as I left. I got to study Will Traynor up close in those first couple of weeks. I saw that he seemed determined not to look anything like the man he had been. He had let his light brown hair grow into a shapeless mess, his stubble crawl across his jaw. His grey eyes were lined with exhaustion or the effect of constant discomfort. Nathan said he was rarely comfortable. They bore the hollow look of someone who was always a few steps removed from the world around him. Sometimes I wondered if it was a defence mechanism, whether the only way to cope with his life was to pretend it wasn't him it was happening to. I wanted to feel sorry for him. I really did. I thought he was the saddest person I'd ever met, in those moments when I glimpsed him staring out of the window. And as the days went by, and I realised that his condition was not just a matter of being stuck in that chair, of the loss of physical freedom, but a never-ending litany of indignities and health problems, of risks and discomforts, I decided that if I were Will, I would probably be pretty miserable too. But, oh Lord, he was vile to me. Everything I said he had a sharp answer for. If I asked him if he was warm enough, he would retort that he was quite capable of letting me know if he needed another blanket. If I asked if the vacuum cleaner was too noisy for him, I hadn't wanted to interrupt his film, he asked me, why had I worked out a way to make it run silently? When I fed him, he complained that the food was too hot or too cold, or that I had brought the next forkful up to his mouth before he had finished the last. He had the ability to twist almost anything I said or did so that I seemed stupid. During those first 2 weeks, I got quite good at keeping my face completely blank, and I would turn away and disappear into the other room and just say as little to him as I possibly could. I started to hate him, and I'm sure he knew it. I hadn't realised it was possible to miss my old job more than I already did. I missed Frank, and the way he actually looked pleased to see me when I arrived in the morning. I missed the customers, their company, and the easy chatter that swelled and dipped gently like a benign sea around me. This house, beautiful and expensive as it was as still and silent as a morgue. 6 months, I repeated under my breath when it felt unbearable. 6 months. And then, on the Thursday, just as I was mixing Will's mid-morning high-calorie drink, I heard Mrs. Traynor's voice in the hall. Except this time there were other voices, too. I waited, the fork still in my hand. I could just make out a woman's voice, young, well-spoken, and a man's. Mrs. Traynor appeared in the kitchen doorway, and I tried to look busy, whisking briskly at the beaker. "Is that made up with 60-40 water and milk?" she asked, peering at the drink. "Yes, it's the strawberry one. Will's friends have come to see him. It would probably be best if you..." "I've got lots of things I should be doing in here," I said. I was actually quite relieved that I would be spared his company for an hour or so. I screwed the lid onto the beaker. "Would your guests like some tea or coffee?" She looked almost surprised.
Yes, that would be very kind. Coffee. I think I'll...
She seemed even more tense than usual, her eyes darting towards the corridor from where we could hear the low murmur of voices. I guessed that Will didn't get many visitors.
I think I'll leave them all to it.
She gazed out into the corridor, her thoughts apparently far away. Rupert. It's Rupert, his old friend from work, she said, suddenly turning towards me. I got the feeling that this was in some way momentous and that she needed to share it with someone, even if it was just me.
And Alicia. They were very close for a bit. Tea would be lovely. Thank you, Miss Clark.
I hesitated a moment before I opened the door, leaning against it with my hip so that I could balance the tray in my hands.
Mrs. Trainer said you might like some coffee, I said as I entered, placing the tray on the low table.
As I placed Will's beaker in the holder of his chair, turning the straw so that he only needed to adjust his head position to reach it, I sneaked a look at his visitors. It was the woman I noticed first. Long-legged and blonde-haired, with pale caramel skin. She was the kind of woman who makes me wonder if humans really are all the same species. She looked like a human racehorse. I had seen these women occasionally. They were usually bouncing up the hill to the castle, clutching small Bowden-clad children, and when they came into the cafe their voices would carry, crystal clear and unself-conscious, as they asked,
"Harry, darling, would you like a coffee? Shall I see if they can do you a macchiato?"
This was definitely a macchiato woman. Everything about her smelt of money, of entitlement, and a life lived as if through the pages of a glossy magazine. Then I looked at her more closely and realised with a jolt that A, she was the woman in Will's skiing photograph, and B, she looked really, really uncomfortable. She had kissed Will on the cheek and was now stepping backwards, smiling awkwardly. She was wearing a brown shearling gilet, the kind of thing that would have made me look like a yeti, and a pale grey cashmere scarf around her neck, which she began to fiddle with as if she couldn't decide whether to unwrap herself or not.
"You look well," she said to him. "Really, you've grown your hair a bit."
Will didn't say a thing. He was just looking at her, his expression as unreadable as ever. I felt a fleeting gratitude that it wasn't just me he looked at like that.
"New chair, eh?"
The man tapped the back of Will's chair, chin compressed, nodding in approval as if he were admiring a top-of-the-range sports car.
"Looks pretty smart. Very high-tech."
I didn't know what to do. I stood there for a moment, shifting from one foot to another until Will's voice broke into the silence.
"Louisa, would you mind putting some more logs on the fire? I think it needs building up a bit."
It was the first time he had used my Christian name.
"Sure," I said. I busied myself by the log burner, stoking the fire and sorting through the basket for logs of the right size. "Gosh, it's cold outside," the woman said. "Nice to have a proper fire."
I opened the door of the wood burner, prodding at the glowing logs with the poker.
"It's a good few degrees colder here than London."
"Yes, definitely,"
the man agreed.
"I was thinking of getting a wood burner at home. Apparently they're much more efficient than an open fire." Alicia stooped a little to inspect this one, as if she'd never actually seen one before.
"Yes, I've heard that," said the man.
"I must look into it. One of those things you mean to do, and then..." She tailed off. "Lovely coffee," she added, after a pause.
"So, what have you been up to, Will?"
The man's voice held a kind of forced joviality to it.
"Not very much, funnily enough. But the physio and stuff, is it all coming on? Any improvement?" "I don't think I'll be skiing any time soon, Rupert,"
Will said, his voice dripping with sarcasm. I almost smiled to myself. This was the Will I knew. I began brushing ash from the hearth. I had the feeling that they were all watching me. The silence felt loaded. I wondered briefly whether the label was sticking out of my jumper and fought the urge to check.
"So," Will said finally, "to what do I owe this pleasure? It's been 8 months."
"Oh, I know. I'm sorry. I've been awfully busy. I have a new job over in Chelsea, managing Sasha Goldstein's boutique. Do you remember Sasha? I've been doing a lot of weekend work, too. It gets terribly busy on Saturdays. Very hard to get time off." Alicia's voice had become brittle. "I did ring a couple of times. Did your mother tell you?"
"Things have been pretty manic at Lewin's. You know what it's like, Will. We've got a new partner, chap from New York, Baines, Dan Baines. You come up against him at all?"
"No."
"Bloody man seems to work 24 hours a day and expects everyone else to do the same."
You could hear the man's palpable relief at having found a topic he was comfortable with.
"You know the old Yank work ethic? No more long lunches, no smutty jokes. Will, I tell you, the whole atmosphere of the place has changed."
"Really?"
"Oh, God, yes. Presenteeism writ large. Sometimes I feel like I daren't leave my chair."
All the air seemed to disappear from the room in a vacuumed rush. Someone coughed. I stood up and wiped my hands on my jeans.
I'm just going to fetch some more logs," I muttered in Will's general direction, and I picked up the basket and fled.
It was freezing outside, but I lingered out there, killing time while I selected pieces of wood. I was trying to calculate whether it was preferable to lose the odd finger to frostbite rather than put myself back into that room. But it was just too cold, and my index finger, which I use for sewing stuff, went blue first, and finally I had to admit defeat. I hauled the wood as slowly as possible, letting myself into the annex, and walked slowly back down the corridor. As I approached the living room, I heard the woman's voice, weaving its way through the slightly open door.
"Actually, Will, there is another reason for us coming here," she was saying. "We have some news."
I hesitated by the door, the log basket braced between my hands.
We thought that it would only be right to let you know, but, well, here's the thing. Rupert and I are getting married."
I stood very still, calculating whether I could turn round without being heard. The woman continued lamely.
"Look, I know this is probably a bit of a shock to you. Actually, it was rather a shock to me. It only really started a long time after."
My arms had begun to ache.
I glanced down at the basket, trying to work out what to do.
Well, you know, you and I, we...
Another weighty silence.
Will, please say something.
Congratulations,
he said finally.
I know what you're thinking, but neither of us meant for this to happen. Really, for an awful long time we were just friends. Friends who were concerned about you. It's just that Rupert was the most terrific support to me after your accident.
Big of him.
Please don't be like this. This is so awful. I have absolutely dreaded telling you. We both have.
Evidently,
Will said flatly. Rupert's voice broke in.
Look, we're only telling you because we both care about you. We didn't want you to hear it from someone else. But you know, life goes on. You must know that. It's been 2 years, after all.
There was silence. I realized I did not want to listen to any more, and started to move softly away from the door, grunting slightly with the effort. But Rupert's voice, when it came again, had grown in volume, so that I could still hear him.
Come on, man! I know it must be terribly hard, all this, but if you care for Lissa at all, you must want her to have a good life.
Say something, Will. Please.
I could picture his face. I could see that look of his that managed to be both unreadable and to convey a kind of distant contempt.
Congratulations, he said finally. I'm sure you'll both be very happy.
Alicia started to protest then, something indistinct, but was interrupted by Rupert.